If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi, I'm Tim Lovejoy, and this is my award-winning podcast, The Lovejoy Hour. Coming up in the next few weeks, music industry boss Alan McGee, who famously signed Oasis.
But I knew they were good, but I didn't know they were superstars when I signed it. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I just thought they're another one of these good bands that I bump into.
I find out about the adult entertainment industry from Kieran Lee, who's one of the biggest porn stars in the world. Excuse the pun.
I'll just look at the director, and he'll just give me a nod, and it's basically countdown, 3, 2, 1.
And on the weekends, I release my football podcast, The A to Zidane of Football.
He looked at me again and he said, "Every time the ball comes in the box, son, you go to bloody pieces."
The Lovejoy Hour, available in all the usual podcast places and some unusual ones too. Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker. 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Mine does chilled filtered water and chilled sparkling filtered water too. I mean, it truly is ace. Thank you to them for sponsoring the podcast. Great product. Thanks a lot. Right, today's hour is our popular 15 questions too, where I ask 15 questions to a celebrity about their life. Today's guest is comedian, actor, TV presenter and author Andy Osho. Being a TV presenter, I love those guests who walk in and you immediately feel like you're going to have a good time. Andy came on Sunday brunch around Christmas time and completely lit up the studio. She was such a great person to have around, funny and charismatic. And she wouldn't let us into the plot line of, Line of Duty. We asked her a lot of times and she wouldn't let us do it. We'll see if I can get Alva by the end of this interview. Here she is. Here's Andy Osho. Hi, Andy. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well, Tim. Thanks for having me on your show.
I'm excited about this podcast because when we were exchanging pleasantries over what time to do, you said there might be a Sainsbury's delivery in the middle of it, and I'd be really let down now if there wasn't.
I can't promise anything, but fingers crossed.
I hope it does arrive.
Because there might be a socially distanced man with a couple of crates, if you're lucky.
Okay. How are things for you anyway? Are you good? You well?
Yeah, I'm really good, actually. I mean, I'm writing, obviously, at the moment because there's not a lot else to do. So, I'm just trying to make the most of being at home and, you know, thinking about what hobbies I'm going to take up if the lockdown goes on any longer, that type of thing.
Oh, what sort of thing have you got in mind?
Well, Tim, I'm not going to lie. Kung Fu is pretty high up on the list.
Yeah.
I watched The Matrix all weekend and I'm just like, damn it, I am going to learn that if it kills me.
Have you watched that? Because I watched a bit of it the other day and I thought, do you know what? It seems I seem to think that I'm living in a different world to everybody else. I'm starting to believe that is true.
Well, you know, I think that metaphorically, like what it's pointing to is that the world is our consciousness, what our consciousness tells us the world is, isn't actually what the world is. So it's a literal expression of that, I would say. So In a way, you're right, basically.
We've all got a different perception, haven't we? But that's very deep. How's the book going?
The book is finished. And so I'm on to another one now. So I'm sort of in the process.
The first book, the fiction book, the one, I can't remember the name of it. I've got it downstairs.
It's all right. I can tell it because I remember it. It's Asking for a Friend.
That's right. Dating.
Yeah. No, because this is the thing. Because we started talking about dating books. I had loads of messages from people going, so is this advice? Is it an advice book? I'm like, no, it's just a made up story about a bunch of women who are trying to get dates. But because the impetus for writing the book came from me reading dating books, I think, you know, probably some people got a little confused. So it's not a dating book.
Me, I got confused. did you enjoy doing Sunday Brunch?
I did. You guys are a lot of fun. Were you? Yeah, were you particularly frivolous that day, or was it always like that?
It's just getting worse or better, whichever way you look at it. But everyone just seems to enjoy coming on the show now. And since we've been in lockdown, it really feels like it's a release for people, especially people like yourself, performers, because you haven't been able to perform for such a long time. So you come on and you just see, as I say in my intro, you just lit up the studio. You came in and you were like, wow, this looks like it's going to be fun. And then you just have fun with it. And it's really, it just seems to be really exciting doing the show at the moment. It's live for a reason at the moment, because people are acting like they're live, you know, whereas often you're live and it seems pointless being live because everything's a bit regimented. But this
right.
is, you know, it feels great at the moment. So,
yeah, it was really fun.
Right. Are you ready to get us stuck into these questions?
Oh, yeah. Questions.
Right, 15 questions. And if I like the answers, you get the bonus one at the end.
Oh.
What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Oh, wait, oh my God, that is the one thing I didn't think through. Well, that invaluable piece of advice. I think it's kind of maybe what I said earlier, that the world, or what your brain reports back to you about what the world is, isn't completely factual. It's like, there's a saying, like, don't always believe what you think. So I think it's like, question what your brain is telling you, because sometimes your perception of something isn't actually what's going on. You know, like when you're having an argument with somebody and you're so embedded in your rightness in it, and they're obviously wrong, because how can they be right if I'm right, sort of thing. So it's like there's a world in which either both of you are right, or maybe you're wrong about the thing. Do you know what I mean?
Do you know, I did a podcast on here about memory. And the one thing about the memory is it's crap. It can't remember anything. And you can literally change your memories if you want to.
Yeah.
And it's up to you if you want to remember. It really is, if you want to, up to you to remember all the bad shit, or you can remember all the good shit.
Yeah.
And when she goes around telling the police force that people's memories, what do you call people? You call them, sorry, I'm really tired today. I've been doing homeschooling. What do you call
witnesses?
Them? Witnesses, that's it.
Right, okay. Here to help, mate.
Wow,
here to
this
help.
Is going to be a long hour for me and for the listener. They tell witnesses, right, that they tell the police that witnesses know nothing. So you've got to be really careful. You can't ever ask witnesses questions which lead them into something, because it jogs a memory they don't actually ever have. And if you and your friend are at an event or something, and you try and talk it through a year later, or even 6 months or a few weeks later, you won't be able to recall it exactly the same. So yeah.
That's happening all the time in terms of, like, in relationships, people remembering arguments or situations that caused arguments in completely different ways. So yeah, I think there was a bit of advice. It would be just take a beat between declaring what you think is the truth and, like, just having to think about, actually, is there any validity into what the other person's saying? You know what I mean? Like that type of thing.
What I've realized watching the internet a lot recently, and this obviously it's very political environment out there, is everybody seems to me at the moment wants everybody else to think like them.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to understand what the other person is thinking, it's like, no, you need to think like me, otherwise I don't like you. And we seem to be obsessively trying to get everyone to think like ourselves, and it's just impossible, because you don't know what their background is or what their circumstances are, what their situations have been. Yet, you know, we seem to be obsessed with doing that.
I suppose that's why people, like, you know, retreat into these so-called echo chambers, because there everyone thinks the same as them. Do you know what I mean? And then I don't know if people are more comfortable like that. I mean, I have tried that thing of, like, you know, they say, oh, you know, try and be Facebook friends or have interactions with people who have opposing political opinions to yourself, sort of thing. But it's quite depressing, because you're just like, oh gosh, you hate everyone. I don't know if I can, I don't want you as my Facebook friend.
I think the only way to do that sort of thing is with human interaction. Online, it's just bullshit, isn't it? I mean, people just talk about it. Some people just obsessed with going online and just arguing. Right, let's go on to the next question. What's the best moment of your career? You've had such a varied career, haven't you?
It's been a lot of, I just realized recently that I just love trying things. And that's brilliant and terrible at the same time, particularly from an agent's perspective, who's trying to, do you know what I mean? Like, shape a career and direct you in one particular direction. But I just love, like, oh, that looks like fun. I'm going to try that and see, you know, see where that leads. But I think in terms of like stuff that's happened so far, a highlight is definitely when I found out that I got Mock the Week, like the first one that I did, because at that time, and I don't know if it's still the case, but all comedians, their attention was focused towards that show. Like it was whether you had done it, whether you could get it, whether you had an agent who was good enough to get you on it, whether you could get on it again. You know what I mean? Like it was everyone's like, it was everyone's North Star. So
When did you do it? Was it during the Frankie Boyle days or post?
No, it was just after that. So Russell Howard was still there, and Hugh and Andy Parsons. But yeah, I think Frankie had just finished. I might have done like a couple of shows after, like been on one of the first shows after he finished on it. But yeah, it was, it's kind of like that endorsement that, you know, we think you might be funny, so we're going to have you on our show. Do you know what I mean? So it's a big day.
Is it weird doing that though? Because you do it and then you have to go home and see if you made the edit when it comes out. Or they let...
They keep you in, but yeah, it's more like, not are you going to make the edit, but are you going to be the giggling imbecile, or are they actually going to use like some of the things that you said? Do you know what I mean? Like just laughing at other people's jokes or actually saying some of your own. So luckily they used, I thought they were quite good to me in the edit, because it can go either way. Do you know what I mean? They could slash you down to nothing, or you know, use your stories and your, you know, whatever material you come up with. So
did you, do you get a chance to write material before the show?
I mean, you can try, but yeah, because basically what you got to do is anticipate what you think is going to be in, or you're not what's going to be in the news, but what out of what's been in the news are they going to talk about? Because there's also some things that, like, for legal reasons, they aren't going to be able to, you know, they can't bring up on the show, or that it's too dark a story. So or like, how are you going to handle that if they do bring up? So it's not as straightforward as what was in the news, write jokes about that. Do you know what I mean? You've got to anticipate editorially what choices they're probably going to make around it.
I did a radio pilot once and they booked me for it. I think it was Clive Anderson who was presenting it. It was like a panel show for Radio 4 or something. I always think I make up my things which happen in my career, because my memory's so bad. I think, did this really happen? You know what? I went on Blue Peter. I hosted Blue Peter for charity once, for Comic Relief, and or Sport Relief. I can't remember. Anyway, I hosted it.
Did you?
And then they got out my show reel of when I the time that I actually auditioned for Blue Peter. They found it and got it out.
Oh my God.
And I went so quiet on the set, and I just was looking at it thinking, oh shit, it was true, because I thought I'd made it up, because it was such a long time ago.
There's evidence.
It was evidence, because I literally have no idea what I did in my career, but I do remember going to a radio studio and there was an audience there and Clive Anderson was doing it. I said, I'll do it, but I'm not like a comedian. I'm not going to do comedy stuff. I'll just mess about and have a laugh. They're like, yeah, fine, turned up. And they put me in a room with writers and I was like, I'm not doing this.
Yeah.
And seriously, and they're going, here are your jokes. And I'm like, seriously, I can't do that because I'm not a comedian. And you know, when you see personalities, celebrities, they try and sell jokes which writers have done. It's horrific.
Yeah.
And so I didn't do it. And I reckon when they sent the pilot to me, I reckon I made it on twice. The whole half an hour, that was it. So it was
twice with no jokes. I mean, that's pretty good going, actually. that's a good ratio.
All right, what was the worst moment in your career, Andy?
I think it was probably when I found out I got Mock the Week. And I say that because honestly, like, when they told me I got it, incredible, great, this is fantastic. And then I was like, shit, I'm not ready for this. This is too much. I went into free fall, just pure panic. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think they booked me like maybe 4 months ahead of me actually doing it. So I had basically 4 months of pure panic. Like, and I'd be living my life. And then I'd remember that I'm doing Mock the Week in like 3 months time, and then panic, and then just calm down again. And then, like, you know what I mean? Like 2 weeks later, just the same thing again. So it was brilliant and terrible at the same time.
It's horrible when something gets in your head because you've got to do it. I listened to a podcast the other day and I can't remember, my memory's so bad, what celebrity it was, but they said, always think, if you won't do it tomorrow, you just say no to it, because in a month's time, you're not going to want to do it either. So unless you want to do it tomorrow, but you did want to do Mock the Week, but then it just sits there, doesn't it? Grating away at you, thinking, I've got to be funny.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, it's unequivocal what the deal is. Do you know what I mean? It's not, they don't want poetry. They don't want songs. It's just pure funny. And so, you know, there's no choice in terms of like, it's going to be clear whether you delivered or not, basically.
And who do you care about most? The fellow, your peer group, the other comics, the audience or the TV producers, who do you care about most, do you think?
I think, if I'm honest, I think it would be just the audience. Our peers is less like, well, that's the least of my problems. Do you know what I mean? What other people think of me. It's more like, or other comedians think of me, but it's more like, well, how's the audience going to receive this? And the other thing that's tricky about it as well is, if people don't know who you are, there's a bigger uphill struggle, in not struggle, but challenge, in terms of getting the audience on side. Whereas if they already know your face, like Dara doesn't have to do as much to get a laugh. Do you know what I mean? That's the fact of it. Whereas, you know, people like me who are new to it really have to haul us. And we just threw all our best stuff, like, you know, into it when we first do Mock the Week. Most people just like, just pow, 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 just get any material that you already have, or any your best jokes, just throw them all in, because you've got to really win the audience over.
And what's the knock-on effect? Did it help?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, because I think what I noticed was there was a kind of a before and after, because there was like, afterwards, other panel shows were like, oh yeah, no, we were totally going to book her. Well, we're going to do it now rather than before she got that Mock the Week. And, you know, so I credit them, like the producers of Mock the Week, with so much, because that definitely like opened a door. And then Open Mike as well, who booked me for loads of stuff, you know, like the Live at the Apollos and McIntyre Road shows and things like that. So yeah, I think Mock the Week definitely sort of flipped a switch in people's minds.
Are you still doing stand-up now, or are you totally doing acting and writing?
I stopped quite a while ago, but God bless Dave, the channel, not humans called Dave, they repeat an awful lot. So I think people still relate to me in terms of comedy, which is fine, but it's kind of like, it's fine until someone wants to book me to do a gig or something, or can you compare our wedding? It's just like, babes, I'm going to stink out the room, something terrible. You do not want me stumbling through a routine I wrote that week, you know, so... Mm-hmm. No, I do miss it though. So I hope at some point I'll you know,
go back to it. What does success mean to you?
Now, having tried all the things that I've tried and done all the things that I've done, I would say just being happy at work. I think that's more important than anything else. And, you know, doing things as a means to an end is fine. But at a certain point, for me anyways, it got to the point of just like, it's got to feel good, like in this moment. It's basically what you were saying about, if you don't want to do it tomorrow, then you're not going to want to do it in a month. It's just like, if it's strategic, I don't know if I want to do that stuff anymore. Like thinking, oh, if I do that gig, that will introduce me to blah, 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 and then I'll get blah, blah, blah. And then I'm hating doing the gig, but I'm thinking about blah, 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 who's a promoter in this instance. But I might use that to reference something else later on, so don't forget that. Do you know what I mean? Like, so just like stuff that makes you happy. Are you enjoying it in the moment? That's how I feel. That makes me feel successful, is I have managed to earn a living and be happy in my work life. That's a win, man. Like, you can't really ask for more than that, because I've done the 9 to 5 as well, and living for the weekend and can't wait to leave work. So I know those two worlds.
Oh, that's good, because that leads me straight into the next question. What other jobs did you do? What were you doing 9 to 5?
I think I've had some of the worst jobs going. So I worked in post-production for about 10 years, right? So I was like, you know, working with editors and sound people and all the rest of it, all the sort of back engine stuff in telly. And then I decided I wanted to be an actor. So to do that, I had to leave that career behind and take just jobs that would allow me to go and audition and stuff. So I ended up working on a reception desk. I was a cab controller. I was a tequila girl, literally the worst job I've ever had, like going around and bothering people, trying to get them to drink this like tequila gunk that the bar made up. And like, you know what I mean? Like with shot glass, literally a holster with shot glasses in it, that I would go around giving, oh God, that was hands down the worst job I've ever had.
Why was that? Because of what, the reaction of the people to you?
It was, I'm not a bother people type of person. Do you know what I mean? Like, for a lot of the time, I just want to sink into the background. I know that seems odd, like, given the work that I do, but I it is not in my personality to just be that, hi guys, you're having a great night. Well, let me just make it worse by giving you some alcohol that you didn't want, overpriced, by the way. So it's just not me. And I remember one of the other girls that was doing it, she said I was uptight and that's why I wasn't enjoying it, sort of thing, or wasn't you know, being able to, because it's a sales job essentially. You're not paid to do it, you're paid per shot. You get a percentage of like whatever you sell. And I just didn't, oh gosh, I just felt like I'm the biggest pain in the ass.
It's a horrific job, that, isn't it? I mean, you watch the girls go around and then they have to befriend these assholes who are drunk trying to get money off them to do. I mean, it's just such a bad idea as a job. How did you get, you wanted to be an actor. Why did you go into stand up first then?
So I went into acting first, then things were kind of, so I came out of the gates pretty good, but then things started slowing down. So I was like, okay, what could I do that could help me get some sort of stage time and give me a bit more control over when and where I get to perform? Because obviously with acting, you can't just go in the street and do some acting. You got to wait for the whole infrastructure to be set up around you. Whereas with stand up, all you need is a room and a stage and you're away, sort of thing. So I was like, all right, let me try that. So that's how it came about. It was more of I just want a bit more control over my sort of performing life, as it were.
Oh, this is terrifying, going on stage and doing stand-up though, isn't it?
It's as terrifying as you would imagine it is. It was like before my first gig, I remember pacing up and down and being unable to speak. I was so scared. And and the actual gig, like, I have like little fragments of it that I can remember, but it just went by in a flash. Like, I was supposed to do 5 minutes, and the next thing I knew, I was getting the, you know, the flashing red light at the back of the room, and I was overrunning. It's just like, what? where did all that time go? It was, yeah, it was madness.
How quickly was it before you became funny? Was it straight away, or did it?
Tim, I was instantly funny.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I mean, I'm embarrassed by that, really. No, I mean, you know what happened is that was a very warm room. So there was a lot of friends and a lot of family and people who knew, because I'd done a course. So this was all the graduates or whatever of this course. So so it was friends and family of those people that were in the room. So we're all funny. Like, do you know what I mean? Everyone wins a prize. But then the real world sort of came in, because my next gig, because the room was packed as well, because everyone had brought friends and family, right? So there was probably about 50 people in the room, and it was a tiny little, but then my next gig was a real gig. And that's when I got to see what the circuit's like at the open mic level. Is basically, you know, more comedians than audience often. And one weird guy who thought that the pub quiz was on that night and then stays and just gets drunk at the back of the room, you know, weird compares, rooms not set up for comedy, landlords that come in and tell you that you have to get out in 10 minutes while someone's still on stage. Do you know what I mean? It was just like, it was kind of horrific. It was not what I was expecting.
Yeah, I've done TV presenting, which I don't find too nerve-wracking. I've done acting, which I don't find, I'm so bad at acting, so I don't find it nerve-wracking at all. It's, if they want me to act, you're stupid, because I'm rubbish. But the idea of going on a stage and just doing stand-up, to me, just fills me with dread. I mean, I literally have had dreams about it. Because of my job, I've had to stand up every now and then and do bits and it's like, I'm going to go up and to be funny is my dream. And I go up and start telling jokes, and you just look at the audience and nothing. And it's like, that must be so horrible.
That, I mean, that is a classic anxiety dream, isn't it? And I still have it. I still have, either I go on stage and I've got to do a stand-up routine, but I haven't got any material. And I keep trying to tell the people that are putting me up on stage, like, you know, I don't have any jokes. And they're like, yes, it'll be fine, on you go, sort of thing. Or I'm in a play. It's always live. It's always on stage. And I'm in a play and I don't know the play. And they're like, don't worry about it. And I, you know, and I have to go on stage. So, yeah, I mean, it's terrifying.
Yeah, that happens with the TV as well. Just, Tim, we're overrunning. Just get on and do some stuff. And it's like, what's the material? And they're like, we'll just give it to you. And then nothing happens. And I'm just stood there. You know? It's always that. Have you done a lot of plays? Have you done a lot of theatre?
Yeah, a bit. Like when I started as well, because, you know, I started as an actor. So most of what you can get access to at that point is theatre work. And so I did that for a while. And then I started to get like TV. So I did like your Holbys and your Casualties. Never got the bill. Always regret that. but yeah, so you do all that stuff. And then for some reason, just it slowed down to pretty much nothing. I wasn't even really auditioning. And that's why I made that choice about stand-up, because I was like getting stage fright when I was going in for auditions. Like I'm not even on stage, I'm auditioning and I can't even like keep it together. So that's it was like purely necessity that had me go and do the stand-up.
I've done TV presenting for about 5 years or something, like on my own show, Soccer M. And I said, you know, I got a bit like I'm a huge star in my mind and all that sort of stuff. I'd got to that stage where I was a bit of a knob and I thought, yeah, I'm pretty cool at this, you know, I get recognized. And then I thought I might as well just wander into acting and do that. It looks fun, you know, and Hollywood and all that sort of stuff. And I wandered into a theater one day to watch something. A mate of mine took me to watch this play, and it was in one of those small theaters. I can't remember what they're called, the one in London where you actually pretty much sit on the stage. And I watched the actor do it and I thought, Jesus Christ, that looks hard work. Does this guy have to do this every night? Yeah. I was so put off with the idea that I would have to do the same shit every night, 8 times a week, or however many times they do it a week. And I was just like, I could not do that job. I mean, just horrific. Did it get boring doing the same stuff every night?
Yeah, you know, I'm one of those people. Some people love theatre, and I do, but I also do get bored. So you got to find ways to keep it interesting. Not, I don't muck about and stuff. Some people do. I don't find that particularly interesting, but you got to find like, okay, new meaning, what the character is talking about, or trying to make a moment funny that hasn't quite worked. Or do you know what I mean? So that it's always, yeah. So that it's always alive, because otherwise it's a slow death, isn't it? Like doing the same, especially if you do one of those like RSC runs or whatever, where you're like 2 years doing the same show. No, thank you.
I just don't know how they can do it. I literally don't know how they can do it. Right, next question. What is your outstanding fashion moment? It could be good and it could be bad, Andy.
Well, I thought it was good. and that's all I'm going to say about that. No, I went to, very short notice, I was invited to the Shazam premiere, because I had a little part in the, you know, DC movie Shazam. And so I had, luckily, I
good
had
movie, it already. That. I loved that movie.
Yeah, Shazam's really great. I really enjoyed him. Yeah,
so did I, yeah.
Not as much as I didn't enjoy the comments about my dress. But anyway, so I went to this premiere and I got this dress. I thought it was like the DBs, you know, it was like it was this white dress, sort of bit of ruching here and there. And it had a sort of grid pattern on it, like grey sort of stripes, like a grid. And I thought it looked really nice. Posted a picture on Instagram, and basically someone said I looked like a maths exam.
That is good, though. That is good.
I mean, I'll give them credit for the joke. But I mean, I was like, you know, you post a picture and you're just like, I'm feeling myself, looking pretty good. And they're like, no, you don't.
So, did you post that prior to going?
After. It was literally me on the red carpet. Oh, what? No, because then it would have been like...
You don't want to do that, do you? Post it and then someone says that, then you've got to go in the actual outfit feeling horrific. I always say this, though. Women get such a harder time than men with clothes. You know, I have to really try hard to get, like, horrible comments about me and what I'm wearing. You know, I mean, there's plenty of horrible comments about me, sorry. But, like, for people to comment on what I'm wearing, it's, like, really hard. I have to go quite extreme. And I do, because I like doing it. I grow a beard sometimes and it's white and I look ridiculous. But I like it because it's sort of... gauges reaction, whereas a woman just has to wear the wrong pair of shoes with her outfit and it's like everyone hammers her. Well, this woman has no style. It's weird.
Yeah, it's really strange. There was this American news anchor, you know, they're often like pairs or whatever, and the guy of the pair, he wore the same suit, like exactly the same suit every day for a year to see if anybody would notice, and they didn't. And he did it intentionally, sort of thing. Whereas this woman, obviously, you know what it's like. They have to change their outfit every single day. Otherwise there's letters, you know? So it was, it's really telling like how women, like you say, we do get a lot more grief about it. I mean, people have been nice about the clothes that I've worn. They haven't always been nice about hair. I do like to mess around when it comes to hair, but yeah, clothes wise, I've been lucky.
Do you know what? It used to frustrate me because I used to always work with women as co-presenters and they used to spend so much time in makeup whilst we were trying to do rehearsing or like little bits before the show. And I used to think, why are they spend so much time? And then after a while you realize they do because they get so much grief over what they look like. And I get none. It's like, oh, Tim's just turned up again in a pair of jeans and a t-shirt.
Yeah. And it's not just your clothes. It's like, oh, are you pregnant? Because, you know, you might have put on a little bit of weight and you're wearing a dress that's maybe a little bit too tight. Yeah, love the dress, but what the fuck with the hair, you know, and stuff like that. It's just like, Jesus Christ, guys, give me a break. I'm like a human being here.
And we all like to think we're thick skinned, but we're not, are we? Because we want people to say we look nice and nice people.
I know I'm not. So I'm just training myself to know where to engage and where not to. That's the only thing I've got. But I'm not thin-skinned, as it were, but I'm not going to pretend like mean comments don't sort of bother me. Although, strangely, someone did a comparison of me with this male football player, and I think they took half of his face and half of mine to say that we were like related or something, or the same person. And it just really made me laugh. It was really, really ugly. As soon as I saw it, I just burst out laughing, which really surprised me because I was like, I should be in a puddle of tears right now. Surely that's who I know myself to be. But I was just like, found it really funny. Not as funny as like enough to post it on Instagram or anything, but
All right. What do you do to keep fit?
What do I talk about doing to keep fit? I think it's more just like trying to do a little something every day. Do you know what I mean? Like just be in relationship with the body. And that sounds like a bit of an odd phrase, but I think we're often quite disconnected in terms of our body. So even if it's just stretching or something basic like that, but I really like running, but I like running on a running machine because I twisted my ankle a couple of years ago and it's still not right. So that's the thing that I really like to do, but I'm not doing it at the moment.
What did you do to it, your ankle?
Mate, you know how like in cartoons you get the birds going around when someone bangs their head, there's a Tweety bird. Well, I got that cymbals and birds, but around my ankle. It was the most pain I've ever been in. There was a tiny little curb and it was about, I don't know, like 2 inches high for going from the pavement to the bike lane. And I was trying to run around a woman because she had a sort of a pram or whatever, but I didn't see that there was a difference in height. So my ankle, and I'm running as well, so it's the full weight of coming down on my ankle just went over on this little lip of the curb. And honestly, I thought I'd broken it. And I was like on the phone to like 111 going, should I go to hospital? I mean, you can't tell over the phone if it's a broken ankle. But yeah, I ended up in A&E. It was horrific.
Have you ever heard of David Goggins?
Yeah. Is he the sort of marketing guy?
No,
yeah.
Okay. So I love Goggins, like everyone who listens to this. He's one of my heroes. I just think he's absolutely brilliant. He's absolutely insane what he does. But I've been working on this. I've been reading up quite a lot because he always talks about just run through things. Just keep going. Your body will fix it. And he's actually run a marathon with a broken leg. And he's done sort of things, you know, because he's insane. But he says the body's really good at healing itself. So I decided to start looking into that. And I'm starting to believe that there is some truth in the fact that our bodies can heal more than we think they can. I think we're too quick to go to, like, I don't know enough about this. I'm so out of my depth and I wish I hadn't started talking about this. But there is there's something to be said for what our brains can, or our minds can do to help heal. So I think you should just run a marathon on your broken ankle tomorrow. Get on with it.
The upshot is get over yourself
and get running again.
I, you know, in a way I do subscribe to that. Like I don't like taking medication as much as possible. I mean, I probably could have tried hobbling it off, I suppose, but I think there probably is something to it, but not for me in that moment.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I went on a psilocybin trial. That's magic mushrooms. They were running a trial, and so I decided to put myself on it. I'm going to do a podcast on it soon. Actually, this was last year, just before lockdown, and I went on two trials, and they stick stuff to your brain. And this, it. Oh God, why have I started this as well?
it's like
a 10-minute conversation. Now I'm going to really sum it up. It opens your mind up in a hippie trippy way, but it does open your mind up. And you think, oh, my mind's really weird. It's I saw a lot more in what was going on in my head than normal life.
Like, but what?
Oh, it's such a, I wish I hadn't started it, but that it makes me believe now that we are much more connected in our minds and stuff. You know what? It takes me onto the Matrix. Andy, I can't do this now because it's gonna go on.
Hey, listen, mate, I'm a believer, so you don't have to, it'll be your listeners that think you're weird, not me.
the interview's about you, not me. I'll sit and bore you with it one day.
Cause it was, all right.
But it was, I did two trials and it was quite an amazing experience. I promised I'd do a podcast. I've actually emailed them today saying, asking them if they want, one of the people who ran the trial want to come on a podcast, because I keep talking about it now. Right. Tell the listeners something that has been life-changing to you.
I did these two trials.
A load of psilocybin.
Yeah.
A load of LSD. I'm a different person.
And that's why I love the Matrix. So, it is kind of along those lines. I mean, I talk about this every podcast, but I did this this workshop back in 2006, and it was about basically sort of revealing a deeper level what human consciousness is. And so I went into it, like my mate introduced me to it, and I went in just like not really knowing what to expect. And she was like, oh, you just come out and you get to be more authentic and like more in the world sort of thing. I was like, yeah, whatever. And what I got from it was just like seeing who I was being in the world that I hadn't seen before. And, you know, like the people I was blaming for stuff, the way that I wasn't being responsible for stuff, the victiminess and self-pity that I had going on. Do you know what I mean? All those sorts of things. So that was like huge, because that was a definite like before and after. And it's not like it was a one course fixes all. I've done other stuff with them, and you just have to keep going on the journey of looking inside. But that was massive, because, yeah, I was a bit of a knobhead before.
What's it called? Can you say?
Yeah, it's called, well, at the time it was called Being in Action. It's Concord Institute. They're the ones that do it. I mean, other places do similar stuff. And it's really, it's basically what Eckhart Tolle is talking about in his books, in, you know, Power of Now and things like that. It's just that we live as though this experience called me is a real thing. But actually there's a space of awareness beyond that, but we don't tap into it at all. We don't experience it or anything like that. So it's about just breaking up the myth of me in a way, so that you can experience. And I haven't even done your mushrooms.
Well, the reason why I did it is I love self-discovery. I think it's great. And the reason why I started this podcast originally, Andy, was because I was doing, I was becoming an acne uncle. I'd read so many self-help books. And then podcasts came into my life, and I was listening to so many podcasts talking about things like psychedelics and stuff and how. So I thought, when I heard about the trial come up, I thought I'd put myself on it. I also put myself on a diet trial. I put myself on all sorts of things because I just quite like looking at the body, and that self-discovery is quite interesting, isn't it? And I think that the one thing that I've realized a lot from watching what's going on the internet at the moment, which I won't get involved in discussing the internet because it's quite a powerful beast which has changed the world. Bowie was right all those years ago. But people are not taking responsibility for their own lives. And I think everybody's sitting around. I've got young daughters, or older daughters now, they're 18. And I keep on saying to them, you've got to take responsibility for your life. There's not this magical politician who's going to come along and change it all for you. So you've got to work out where you are in the world, take responsibility for it, and then work out what's happening around you. And I just don't think people are taking responsibility for themselves. You say the victim thing. It's like there are a lot of victims out there. We must point that out. But, you know, it's like, I just think it needs to start taking responsibility for where they are. I think it's a great idea to do something like that.
Yeah, I mean, the victim thing is really interesting because it's just easier. And the thing is, I think most people that dwell in that space, or most of the time that we all do occasionally dwell in that space, we don't realize that's what we're doing. We feel like we're justified in saying, well, so-and-so did such and such to me, or this organization has treated me like this, and therefore I'm just going to live in this, like, you know, repetitive complaint. Rather than just going, okay, maybe I can be responsible for my how I'm experiencing it, or how I'm feeling about it. Do you know what I mean?
That's it. Because I've slipped into that mode quite a lot of times in my life. Right? Do you have any daily routines?
Daily routines. I got some good routines, and I got some not so good routines.
Which ones do we want to hear about? I don't mind. Take your pick.
Well, I mean, no, I'm not going to go into that. Anyway, look, first thing I do, I have to set an alarm because I'm not one of these people that just naturally wakes up at the sun. But I can't stop looking at bloody social media, and it's become a proper routine. Look, it's a habit now. And I think
when you say habit, I say addiction, Andy.
I think you might be right, Tim. I'm not going to fight you on that. I think I might need to buy an actual wind the back up alarm clock, because the alarm goes off and I'd go to turn that off, or snooze more likely. And then there it is, Instagram notifications, Facebook notifications, whatever's. And I'm in, I'm down the rabbit hole. You know what I mean? It could be for a good 10 minutes. So that is a habit or part of my routine that I don't want. But I cook a lot. That's a good routine. I cook at home as much as I can. Because I think that, you know, giving over our food to industry is part of why we're not well as a society. I think we got to reclaim that back and find a way to even these meal boxes. I'm not entirely sort of on board with, because what's the source of them all? Do you know what I mean? Like, where is all this meat? Where's the meat product coming from? Or, you know, where's the dairy coming from? So I think we should be cooking more at home. So I try and do that. So that's a routine that is just like very embedded into my day.
Good idea. I think the my mobile phone addiction has become unmanageable at the moment. The lockdown is killing me because you don't go out anymore or as much. I just can't help turning to my phone, but I'm really aware of it.
Yeah.
And I just don't know what to do about it. It just keeps, if I want to watch anything on TV, I literally have to put the phone in the other room now. Otherwise I just keep picking it up. I just don't watch anything anymore. It's just,
do you know what happened the other day? As I was scrolling through Instagram, I got that, I don't know if you've seen it as well, that notification on Instagram that goes, "You're all caught up." And my heart sank because are you telling me I've been here so long? I've seen all of Instagram. Like that's when you know you've been on it too much.
that's bad. All right, let's move on to the next question, because it probably goes on nicely. How's your mental health?
You know, it's pretty good, actually. I'm doing okay. I have my moments, like we all do, but I think I'm on this journey, I guess, not deliberately, but I'm just finding what works. Because I think it's very easy, and I did up until I did these courses, get into this mode of like being comfortable in my discomfort. Like, you're so ensconced in some way of being that's not working, but you're so used to it that you don't do anything about it. I'm not about that anymore. So if something's not working, like, I have a tendency to overload myself with stuff, and I really got a wake up call around that before Christmas. So now I'm just really taking responsibility for that, because I did go into victim mode. Oh, look what the world wants from me. Oh, it was asking me to do too much stuff, blah blah blah. But now I'm just like learning to, like, the power of no, the beauty of no.
Okay, something that you will be, I'm expecting a lot of knowledge on this, is what's the key to a good relationship? Because you've written a book on it, basically.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it is a fiction. Because seriously, people are asking me for advice now. It's just like, babe, I ain't got it. Yeah, a good relationship. I think I came up with this phrase the other day, the fairy tale complex. And wow. I think that part of really having a healthy relationship is breaking the spell of this fairy tale complex so that you can really have what works for you in a relationship. Because I can say this with absolute experience, because I know that that's what I've been chasing for years and years and years, thinking it should look like this. It should be, he falls in love with me, then I fall in love with him, then he buys me flowers, then we move in together, then you know, maybe the drawer first, you know, in the chest of drawers, and then we move in together, and then all, you know what I mean, and it's all pre-described, all these things that should happen. And when I realized that that's what I was chasing, but it actually doesn't work for me, it was a really liberating moment, because I was just like, oh, so I can actually have a relationship in a way that works for me outside of whatever that, you know, predetermined model is. And I realized that for me, I need a lot more space than I was giving myself. And I also realize that I need
this. That comes up, sorry, Andy, that comes up a lot on this. People say, what's the success relationship? How to have a successful relationship, they say space.
Yeah.
So many people say space. It's really interesting. That, and I suppose the Hollywood dream is that you live with each other in a montage.
Oh my God. Yes, that's such a good description of it. Like, I was looking for my romantic montage, but it was it's not gonna work. Because what I realized the other day is, why do I want to be that close to someone in an intimate relationship when I don't have that in any of my other relationships? Yeah. Like, my work relationships aren't like that. I have space. My friendships aren't like that. I've loads of room, loads of latitude with my friends. My family, even with my family, we're not like that. So why suddenly do I want to live in somebody's pocket because we're having sex? Basically. So space, or just, it's not even just about space, it's about defining it on your terms, really asking yourself what actually works for you outside of that fairy tale. What do you really want?
We always say on this podcast, when we were doing the agony bit years ago, it was like, when you're looking for a relationship, if you meet the guy or the girl and they make your heart flutter and your palms sweaty, and that's not your partner for life. That's just someone to have sex with, probably.
Yeah.
What you really want is a comfortable pair of slippers. That is what you want, because, you know, you got, and you really want someone who's going to be your friend if you're going to spend a lot of time with them.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to be able to sort of just watch Netflix and just giggle about stuff and just chill. Because you're absolutely right. I think the person that gives you palpitations, you don't want to be living in a constant state of panic. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you want someone you can chill with, and exactly, someone who just makes you feel relaxed, or gives you the room to be relaxed in.
Yeah. All right. What's it like to be famous?
I don't know. You tell me, Famo.
It's your interview, not mine.
Our interview. I've had little moments of it, but I don't think of myself as famous. I think of myself as someone that's been on the telly a few times, because I can very easily go to my local Boots and TK Maxx and no one knows who I am. So I think famous is, to me anyways, in my mind, it's like, can't do that. Or can and will get spotted, you know.
Do you remember the first time you got recognised?
Yeah, I do. It was for EastEnders, and I was playing this nurse, and someone shouted at me from across the street. They were like, "Oi!" As they do. "Oi, nurse, EastEnders!" And I was thrilled. It was just like, man, this is what it's all about. That's what I was thinking at the time. Yeah, I got recognised off EastEnders.
The first time I got recognised, I remember it vividly. I was in Tesco's and someone came up and went, "You're that bloke off the football show, aren't you?" And I went, "Yeah." And I just didn't know what to do. I just went bright red and got embarrassed. And went, I wasn't expecting that. No one had ever recognised me before. So I just didn't know how to react to it at all. And then next time I thought, yeah, I'm the man. Get me to Hollywood. Come on.
It is. It's, I mean, I'm not going to lie. It can be like an addictive feeling, right? Because it's like, especially people being lovely. If they're not, then not so much. But like, if, you know, because people, I know what, I remember what I was like when I've met people who I've seen off the TV or in a band that I like or whatever. And you're not quite yourself. So, yeah. you know, it's quite heightened state kind of thing. So when people are coming at you with that energy, it's quite intoxicating kind of thing. But like I say, because I've had... you know, I very much go in and out. So like when I was doing loads of Motley Weeks, then, you know, people would be coming up to me. I remember some woman on the train, like basically traversed the whole length of a tube carriage to come and tell me I was on Motley Weeks sort of thing. But then, you know, when I'm not doing that sort of stuff, I sort of, you know, disappear. I think I've got one of those just faces who just like, because people, I don't know if you get this a lot as well. People come up to me and they go, do you know where the nearest post office is? And I'm totally geared up for them. Yeah, you saw me on Shazam. I get you. Okay, girl. And they're like, oh no, I'm actually looking for, or did you used to teach my 4-year old? No,
I get that sometimes where I get people come and go, hey, how are you? And I'm like, yeah, fine. I don't recognize them. They go, oh shit, sorry, you're not my friend, are you? You're the bloke of 10. it's like, yeah. And I always take that as a compliment because I think that means they are so comfortable. They've watched me so much that they just think I'm part of their friendship group and then realize I'm not. So,
have you ever done that thing when you meet someone who's famous, but the moment before you realize they're famous, you do that, like you're going to say, aren't you the blah, blah, blah? Or aren't you, you know, didn't you teach my kids? And then you realize who they are. So then you have to stop. I've done that before. I've like met a Blue Peter presenter or something and then thought I went to school with them or something.
That's what people do to me all the time. That's exactly what happens. So, all right, when's the happiest you've ever felt?
Happiest I ever felt. I'm going to say it's more like, I don't know if it's happy, more ecstatic really. It was when I met Bros.
Wow.
Yeah, actually, no, I didn't really meet them. It was more like I screamed in their faces because I was sort of 14 or something. This is like when Bros were Bros rather than two separate entities, ships passing in the night. But yeah, I used to spend like a lot of time just prowling the streets with my mates looking for them.
But I lived near Bros. I'd moved to London and they were living in Maida Vale.
Yeah.
That's where they lived. And every time we went out, I'll tell you this story because I'm not proud of it, but every time we went out there was like girls everywhere waiting for Bros to come out of their houses. Is that where you used to prowl around?
Yeah. And they told us that, you know, like if they were doing like Radio 1 or whatever, I remember going down to Radio 1 and there were literally hundreds of us outside of, right? I mean, I don't know if any band could get that nowadays, you know what I mean? Because people are just so used to seeing celebrities everywhere. But yeah, there were hundreds of us. And we used to go down to like Television Center, like if they were doing, what was it, Saturday Superstore or whatever it's called. So yeah, I'd like...
So I walked out of my flat to go to the shops and there was all the girls hanging around the shops. And I remember just getting up and I was a bit hungover or something. And I just put jogging bottoms on. I was about 18 or something, 19 or something. Just put jogging bottoms on and that was it. Because, you know, I was sleeping nudie doody. And
okay.
And I just remember this thing that the jogging bottoms were quite tight-ish, really. And then these girls were just standing there and I was just sort of walking along minding my own business. And the girl nudges her mate and goes, oh, no, you see that man's penis? And I was like, oh, my God. I was so embarrassed. It was ridiculous. I've told you two stories where I've gone bright red in the streets.
This is great. What else do you want to tell me?
Nah. So which is your favourite, Matt or Luke?
I think... that actually at
or
the time
Craig, or
it
Craig.
Was Craig. I think it was Craig. Maybe I just felt for the outsider, you know. Maybe that's what it is. I mean, he's kind of the more successful one out of all of them now anyway, isn't he? So
he's a record producer or something.
Yeah exactly.
Yeah. All right, my favorite question, and basically the other 14 questions are all just padding for this one question.
Oh really? Okay.
Have you ever seen a ghost or a UFO?
Oh man, I wish I'd seen a UFO. Never either, but I do feel sorry. I'm sorry, but I do think I sensed a ghost. Is that count.
Okay. Go on.
All right. So hear me out. What happened was, so we stayed in the, I think it's the oldest hotel in Stratford-upon-Avon. I think it's called The Swan. And one half of it is like literally like 16th century or something. So I said, yeah, that sounds cool. Let's stay that side. And I got that sleep paralysis thing.
Yep.
So, I mean, I guess on some level it's just physiological or whatever, but I was terrified. I just woke up in the middle of the night. I was just like absolutely just pinned to the bed. So yeah, I think that was ghosts. That's it. That's all I've got.
That's just crap. I want to actually see something.
So
do you see ghosts or UFOs? Yeah, they're so prevalent in our thinking and our talking and our lives, aren't they, really? And I just can't believe I've never seen one.
Well, they're quite discreet, I think.
They are. Why are they so bloody discreet? What's the point in being them if they don't let us see them? So.
Well, maybe that's one of those sort of advanced human or humanoid ways of being that they've managed to do that we can't. They maybe. Can be discreet. We're not discreet like they are.
Yeah, a parallel universe type of thing, or what? A different. Oh God, I'm going on about nothing here. Right, is there something you've changed your mind about?
Something I've changed my mind about. Oh,
the reason why we asked that question is on this podcast. I bore our listeners with this again, but you know, I was all for all drugs being illegal, and then after doing 3 or 4 podcasts on it, we need drug reform. It's just mad, and I completely changed my mind. And when they first talk about it, the people on my podcast are like, "What, you think drugs should be legal?" And you know, and it's like, yeah, it makes sense. I won't go into it now. So I've completely changed my mind, you know, being born in an era where drugs were always illegal. I've never known them not to be
right
legal. So yeah, prohibition didn't work, as we know.
And
drug reform is necessary.
Well, it's interesting because on that front, I honestly thought that it would be okay to have athletes take whatever they wanted. Because to my mind, it's just like, fine, then all right, maybe we'll have some sort of super duper Olympics. And that's where all the drug, you know, the athletes taking drugs would compete. And, you know, the other athletes, I don't know, would be in the regular Olympics or something. And then someone pointed out to me that not every athlete wants to do that.
And also, it puts a lot of stress on the heart, and the money side of things is, you know, that they'll want the cash, so they'll push themselves further and further. And
yeah, exactly. It's just it morally, for many reasons, it would be wrong. So yeah. that changed my mind, because I honestly did think, just like, fine, let them do what they want. They're doing it anyway, is what I was thinking.
Yeah.
So just let make it legal, so that it can just, that'll level the playing field, is if you can do whatever you want. And then someone was just like, you're actually being stupid. Stop being also, stupid about this.
Also, a lot of kids are taking them, sadly, because every sport now, the bigger you get, the better you are. The taller you are, the better you are, generally, apart from football. But, you know, you've taken steroids, you've got an advantage over your competitor. And the financial gains of being a pro sportsman are so, you know, they're so high now that people will do anything, and kids are being offered steroids, and so it's not good for them.
Right, okay.
That's a real, I think it's a real problem in professional sport, especially endurance athletes who get offered it a lot, I hear, but I know nothing. Bonus question, because I've loved
hello.
Answers, Andy. What is the meaning of life?
The meaning of life. I think, this is going to sound a bit like cliche, but I genuinely think that it's not, you know, this whole journey destination thing. I think that the universe puts desire in the human experience to make us move. But the desire, which feels, you know, objective driven, i.e. I want to reach this goal, I want to have a boyfriend or whatever it is. The desire is merely to get you up out of your seat and move, because the universe isn't bothered about you achieving the goal. It just wants us all to journey. That's what the meaning of life is taking the journey. But there's no way we would get up and move if there weren't an objective. That's how human consciousness is set up. So the universe gives us desire to make us get up and go.
I love that. I love all these theories. I'm working on one at the moment, which is very loosely working on it. And it's a bit nuts, but I'm wondering whether the meaning is it. Meaning of life is to get rid of all desires, get rid of everything, as the Buddhists will say in that, and literally just stop. I wonder if the meaning of life is to be eaten rather than be eating something. I wonder if the idea is to end the game, not continue the game. I wonder if we're in a circle of hell rather than so. Hey, those drugs are really good, by the way.
I'm going to say, I'm not loving this theory. So basically, you get eaten to death.
Well, I just wonder. There's a lot. I was watching that Attenborough show the other day, and there's a lot of animals get eaten. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
Every time we moan when we're humans, you've got to realize we haven't got something trying to eat us every day. So, you know, there's that going.
Yeah, I mean, lions and, I mean, not lions, because they don't get eaten either, but, yeah, gazelles or whatever have got more to complain about than... than we do,
and
for
we
sure.
We do, yeah, they do. Yeah. They do,
yeah. Okay. You think you've got problems, pal? But
then I thought maybe they've sussed it. Maybe they're the meaning of life, to get eaten. Right, that's...
Yeah, but they're more comfortable in their place in the circle of life. We are not, because we haven't reconciled death.
Yeah, and because we've got a conscience, so... we're thinking about it constantly, but they're not, are they? They just turn it on.
No, they're just living their best life until they're not. It's yeah. A pretty blissful existence, actually.
Andy, it's been lovely talking to you. When's Line of Duty on? How far away are we from that?
I think it's April, and that is literally the only intel you're getting out of me. I know you're.
What else have you got coming up?
My book is going to be out very soon. Oh, I don't know when this podcast goes out, but it's out on the 4th of Feb. And so I'm really excited about that because, you know, I hope it's really funny. I hope people find it funny because I didn't do a stand-up DVD. So to me, this is my offering to people. Do you know what I mean? Like, instead of a DVD, it's a book. So
right. Yeah. Oh, I thought it was already out.
No, babes. So 4th of Feb.
Because I've got one downstairs. So
have you now?
Yeah, I'll give it a read. if people want to follow you, because you obviously you've done Instagram. Instagram, Twitter, are they the same names?
Is that yeah, I think Instagram is the Andy O Show with a W on the end, and then Twitter is just Andy O Show. Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah. Thank you so much for doing that. This. Thank you so much for doing this. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Thanks, Andy.
Cool. Thanks for having me on.
The Lovejoy Hour is written and presented by Tim Lovejoy, produced by Blake Fellows, and sponsored by Quooker. If you want to get in touch, email lovejoyhour@gmail.com, or you can find Tim on Twitter and on Instagram.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.